morning. Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl this last hour. Earl is off doing what Earl does so very well. Say, Sam, now that Earl's gone, think we can talk about him for this last hour?
I've been dying for this moment.
Little does he know, his ears can burn, you know. Actually, Earl does deserve to be talked about a little bit because he does some really spectacularly good things. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that the listeners out there understand what Earl does when he's not doing his radio show. But one of the things he's highly involved with, I mean, right now he's going to the graduation of his foster child, but that is a story unto itself. But skipping from that to Voice of the Elders, has he talked much about Voice of the Elders on the show?
I know that his big, I don't know if you want to call it like event or program is launching soon. He's mentioned it briefly, but nothing crazy.
Well, Voice of the Elders is all Earl. He generated the idea, and the idea is to get numbers of people, older guys, men particularly, who live in the city, most of them African American, to mentor young people, and to particularly mentor young people in the middle school ages who are at risk, highly at risk. And you know, we all know in the Milwaukee area the huge problem we have with stolen cars, the danger that stolen cars present to the public at large, how ruinous it is to the kids who involve themselves in doing stolen cars, both in terms of the terrible injuries they have in automobile accidents, but also what it does to their futures based on establishing a criminal record and a path for their life that isn't positive. And Earl identified this, was able through all of his contacts to line up a large group of exceedingly energized and wise and able guys to serve as mentors. He's worked with the Milwaukee public schools. He's worked with the police. He's got a program up and going. They're meeting actively with young people, having an impact. And so it's a program that has a great deal of promise. And Earl has done this all himself, just much the same way when he set up a junior football program that at one point had thousands of participants in the city of Milwaukee. So I can't say enough about Earl and his energy and his inclinations and instincts, because they're all good. He's a remarkable guy. We're lucky to have him talking to the city. We're lucky to have him in the city. So, Earl, I hope you're listening. I congratulate you every day when I wake up. You're a great man. We were talking before he left so abruptly. And we were talking about the problems in American society right now and the extent to which people who want to identify and look at the problems in society might be viewed negatively by those who think that American exceptionalism is the rule of the day. In fact, Ted Cruz just a couple of weeks ago, I think, took great umbrage at someone who asked how it was that in a country that viewed itself as being so exceptional, this was a foreign reporter, would have so many murders of young children, would have situations like the Uvalde school situation occurring, and how could we possibly view that as part of an exceptional society? And he took great umbrage at that and said, I'm so sorry that you have a negative view of American exceptionalism, as if America was exceptional in all regards. And I think that's a problem. That's a serious social problem we have. That we, if we aren't willing to look at and try to figure out why this is going on, I've got a son who's a middle school teacher who has literally grieved ever since the Uvalde thing, because it seems so like such a futile issue to talk about. Like every couple of months, we have a similar circumstance. We've had literally hundreds and hundreds of school children killed in their schools. And we've had gun incidents with multiple killings. I mean, in 1 year, we have more killings in the United States with mass gun-based homicides, mass killings, than the world has in decades. And so is that a problem? Does that reflect some social problem we have in our country? It certainly does. And those who want to defend the NRA's position would assert that maybe the problems that create this are created by liberal thinking, by the woke, the so-called woke political approach, by I don't know what. It's gaslighting at the highest level to try and assert that the basis of the gun problem in the United States is not the fact that we have 400 million guns in the United States. I mean, that's the elephant in the room. We're the only country that has that much armament available to in society at large. We're the only country that has the, that kind of weaponry such that everybody on the street, 12-year-olds who want to carry a gun can find a gun and carry it and can buy one at some what must be an affordable price to them and can do so without any sort of background check. So lots of this political debate about passing laws that will somehow make it harder to buy guns ignores the fact that we have over 400 million guns. We have millions of assault rifles already in circulation in the country, already available to be bought on a person-to-person exchange that requires no background check. So if we're going to address the gun problem in the United States and the loss of life as the result of guns in the United States, don't we have to face the reality that it's the existence of guns and it's the existence of millions and millions of guns in the United States that is the basic problem? You know, we can talk about it being, we, you know, the NRA will say, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, people with guns kill people, and people with guns kill many people. You know, in Japan, when they have a mass murder, it's somebody with a knife who goes crazy and kills one or two people with a knife. In the United States, when we have someone who goes crazy, they'll kill 69 people in Las Vegas with a gun. So what's the difference there? Well, the difference is that crazy people in the United States have access to guns and can kill many, many people at once. Now, so, you know, guns. We can set guns aside maybe as an issue and say, okay, maybe guns are an issue that we should set aside and not include in the America is exceptional kind of view of the world. Although there are those on the conservative side who would say, well, America is exceptional because we have the Second Amendment and we have this right to bear arms in the United States that isn't available in other countries. Okay, but what's exceptional about that? You know, how does that create an exceptional value for the American people? We can jump to other subjects. We could jump to, for instance, healthcare. There are those who would say that we have an exceptional healthcare system because we can provide the most sophisticated kind of healthcare to in the world. And it is true that people from Saudi Arabia, people from all over the world with money will travel to the United States to get the most sophisticated kind of healthcare. But is that healthcare available to a middle-class worker, a 30-year-old waitress, a woman who's away on a wait staff that can't afford healthcare insurance, who doesn't qualify for Medicaid, who develops breast cancer? And how will it work out for her? And how available is the healthcare that's so sophisticated to a person without means? And what does that mean for American exceptionalism? Because is it exceptional because we have the healthcare available to the world? Or should our healthcare be measured as exceptional because it's available to everybody in this country who then gets the healthcare? Let's talk about childhood. Let's talk about entry to this world. We have a nation that is that argues a great deal about pro-life and abortion rights and family planning rights and the right of a woman to make a decision. These are hotly contested issues. But what about when the child is born? How hotly contested are the issues and how supportive are the people who are so pro-life? How supportive are they about the issue of taking care of that life once it enters once it starts in the United States. Because in Europe, a child born is born into a circumstance in which the important things for that child's health and welfare are taken care of for sure. That child will get child daycare. That child will get health care. That child will get educated through its entire life up to its adulthood without a concern about having substantial money in order to pay for it. All of those things are taken care of in Europe and supported, so that that child born has a birthright that provides it with a great deal of opportunity. What's the story in the United States? Well, first of all, we have one of the highest birth rate mortality rates in of all of the developed nations, because our healthcare system doesn't support young women giving birth in the same manner that it is supported in other countries. And then once that child is born, we have a child morbidity rate that is not the best in the world. And so we'll get back to this after a break. We're coming up on a break shortly, but I thought we'd unbundle a little bit some of what is so exceptional about America. Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram. The Earl had to go off to his son's graduation. That's an important thing to do. Sam, how are you?
I'm great, Sandy. Just the two of us now.
Absolutely. Can you tell people how they can text in or call?
Of course. Yeah, thanks for tuning in to the Earl Ingram Show here on 101 FM The Shaw, as well as 540 AM WAUK. And call or text here at 844-967-2789.
So we were talking before the break. I was trying to unbundle American exceptionalism, you know, and I don't want anyone to mistake the discussion for a notion that I don't think America is a fantastic country. It is, because every country has shortcomings associated with it. You know, some of the shortcomings in some places, Norway, which seems to be a nirvana, I suppose, has the problem of it being not a very diverse place. If you're in Norway, you'll basically spend a lot of time with Norwegians. And Europe does have the benefit of being a continent, at least the Western Europe, as a continent in which the countries were formed based on ethnicities and sort of the purified ethnicities of sharing a language, sharing a culture, sharing an ethnicity. That's what the French are. That's what the Germans are. So, I mean, our country's different. We're a melting pot. And we have a lot of circumstances that make the governance of our country different and maybe more difficult. But to me, that's an enrichment. We have this melting pot. It's a fantastic circumstance to live in. The ability to be on the radio fearlessly, to talk about anything we want to talk about, to try and look at our circumstance objectively is a wonderful opportunity. But in terms of our culture right now, I think that we have something that we need to talk about, and our socio-political system, and that is that we've seemed to embrace and have embraced for quite a while a concept of American exceptionalism that causes us to be blind to the ways in which we aren't achieving our full potential. You know, the potential of this country is unbelievable. We have natural resources unlike any other country in the world. We have a big geography that is rich with natural resources. We have a system developed, a financial system and a political system that supports business development unlike any other system in the world. But we also have circumstances that are failing. And I think one of the ways we're failing is we're failing the people. The people who make up the bulk of our population, who are not experiencing their full potential, and they aren't experiencing it because our country hasn't adapted a socio-political system that supports it. Sam, before the break, we were talking about neonatal care and postnatal care and pro-life issues, and I think you brought up off the record, off the air, an interesting issue, which is the current baby formula problem, right?
Yeah, I mean, you see Republicans saying how pro-life they are, and then they don't sign bills to produce more baby formula. It's like, oh, you're only pro-life until it comes out? Like, I don't understand why that was not approved.
Well, I mean, and the pro-life situation, basically that women should be required, regardless of what their intent or desire is, they should be required to bear a child through to birth, ignores the fact that America's the health situation for an expectant mother in the United States is not the best in the world. There are more complications in childbirth in the United States than in most of the developed countries of Europe and in the rest of the world. And similarly, the child morbidity rate, the death rate of the birth rate of children is not the best in the world by quite a long shot. At least that's my understanding. So these pro-life people are willing to require that a woman essentially risk her life and risk the life of a child carried all the way through to birth, risk their lives in a health system which will not protect them in the same manner that they could be protected in other health systems. And then, yeah, go ahead.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but these women that tend to have abortions usually are on the less fortunate side. They probably can't afford having a child as is, but if we make them have it, again, it is being put into the healthcare system that the mother, again, cannot afford. And it's just adding on top of all of those financial burdens that already exist, leaving the mother to have to do what, you know, like make sacrifices already that she knew she could not make and why she would not want to keep. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Clearly the women who would make a decision not to bear a child are making a decision based on their view of how that child would experience life if born, right? And so there is a judgment that's being made that is pessimistic about the quality of life that a child would experience upon birth, that probably to some extent is a self-fulfilling prophecy if that child is required to be born. And furthermore, you know, this life risk that the mother takes and this risk that the child takes from the health standpoint is then also this children in America are more likely to be born into poverty than they would be in 38 other countries in the world. So, you know, the child poverty rate is substantial in this country, and children born into poverty in this country do not have the benefit that children born into poverty had in other developed countries. What kind of benefits are that? Well, most developed countries have child daycare available. Most developed countries have health care assured to the children from birth and for all citizens from birth. And they have education systems that will carry that child forward and give them all the opportunities possible. So poverty doesn't have to be such an awful outcome for a child born into poverty, but it is in the United States. Poverty in the United States creates a very low likelihood, much lower likelihood of success than it does in many other countries. Even though we are a land of opportunity, we have decided not to provide full opportunities to children born into this country, born in this country, based on the political process, which has been unwilling to adopt the same sort of safety net that exists in all the developed countries. And my concern is that when we talk about that safety net, we talk about it without focusing on children, because children are the ones on whom this system has the greatest impact, and it's children that are the thread of the future, and it's children who are not born into a system which gives them opportunity, which actually are the threat to the future as well. So they're the threat of the future and the threat to the future, because forcing women to bear children into an environment in which they will not thrive creates the very sort of situation that now when I talked earlier on the show about Earl Ingram and the voice of the elders, he is actively trying to work with children who are now 11, 12 years old, who were born into situations in which they were relatively hopeless and which drove them in a direction of being extremely at risk to themselves and to society. And so this is a not an uncomplicated problem. It's not as simple as simply saying that all children who are conceived ought to be born. That doesn't end the discussion. That begins the discussion. And I think what's unfortunate is our political process in America right now starts with the starting point of that discussion, which is what should we do about children that are conceived? Should they be required to be carried by the mother through to birth? That's just the beginning of a discussion, which should then basically have all of the meat of discussion be, what do we do with children once they're born? We can talk about that when we return from break. Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram this last hour. Sam, how do people text or call in?
844-967-2789, and I'll screen your call or text.
So, in fact, speaking of call-ins, I guess, you know, we frequently have callers, CJ, Gary, we have Dave, who are who come at this from a more conservative angle than possibly Earl and I do. And I'm wondering, I sort of challenge them to call in on this issue that we're now talking about, which is essentially the birthright of children to be born into circumstances which would take care of their health and which would take care of their education and welfare, and how it is that conservatives propose to take care of those issues. You know, in the developed countries of the world, other developed countries of the world, children are born into a system in which they are assured of health care, they're assured of child daycare. They're, in most countries, their mothers or fathers are assured of maternity or paternity leave so that they are cared for by their parents for a period of time in their early childhood. And none of these things are provided and assured in America for children. And I'm curious what the conservative view of that is. I've never really heard a rationale for why it is that we in our country have concluded that we would not provide our children with all of that same kind of support, while at the same time, we have probably the most strident argument going on about whether mothers should be required to, or women who become pregnant should be required to bear that pregnancy all the way through the gestation period to childbirth, and the government to make that decision for them. And so I don't know whether we've got listeners who want to call in on that issue, but I think that it's hard to have the discussion about what it is we should be doing without at least somebody trying to provide a explanation for why it is that we do what we do, which is to basically ignore those interests. We've provided Medicare for the elderly and elderly starting at age 62 now. And that Medicare is there because we realize that medical aid and medical support and medical care for people over 62 is a necessity. Well, medical care is a necessity for everyone of every age, but it's a particular necessity for the young, for those once from the time of birth onward. And yet we don't have a system other than for the people who qualify because of poverty for Medicaid, but we have the whole middle income group for whom this is not assured and for whom we basically said, look, we hope you're lucky enough to be born into a family in which the family income is sufficient to support medical insurance, because otherwise you aren't going to receive the medical care you need as a child. And we hope you're born into a family that has the wherewithal to have child daycare for you, because otherwise you're going to be a latchkey child who is not going to receive the daycare you need. And why have we come to this point? On a show several weeks ago, we did some simple math to figure out how much a family would have to earn in today's circumstance in America to be able to afford to buy healthcare insurance and to provide daycare for their young children. And we realized that it's well over the median income in the United States for families of $75 million. It's probably over $75,000. And it's probably over $100,000 that a family would have to earn to actually be able to afford to provide both daycare, good housing, and health care to their children and to their families. And why is it that we as a government haven't decided that we should provide health care to, for instance, children from age 0 to 21 when they're otherwise not able to provide it for themselves and have to rely on their family and their family circumstance to figure out whether they get the health care they need? And if we're going to provide health care to people who are ages 62 and older, and if it isn't obvious that we should be providing healthcare or assuring it to people age 0 to 21, then why aren't we simply just biting the bullet like other countries have, every other country has just about, and assuring that we have healthcare for everyone from age 0 to their death? And it's a mystery to me. How did we evolve in America to this position of having a society which views itself as exceptional, but we don't provide health care from the beginning to the end of life? And similarly, education. Sam, you have student loans that you have to pay back? You do, don't you?
Oh, yes. It's looming over my head as we speak.
Well, you know, what's clear from the evidence and from just looking backwards in time at the evidence of what happened to tuitions and what happened to the student loan rate is that as tuitions have gone up far faster than inflation, it has happened at the same time that student loans flew up in scale. I mean, we're at $1.7 trillion of student loans, and most of those loans have been incurred in the last 25 years. And so that's a stupendous rate of student loans being incurred. And lots of it has been because our state legislatures across the country have decided to withdraw tax-supported funding from public universities. The price of going to a public university in this country is now materially higher than it was 30 years ago, materially higher. And the reason for that is that we're asking young people to incur personal loans to replace the taxpayer subsidy that used to exist for public universities in this country. So is the forgiveness of a student loan a handout? No, maybe it's just a recognition that those student loans are replacing what used to be tax-supported, the public recognition of the need to support public education through college so that our economy and our society would be supported by all these people with a higher education. All right, I take it a student loan forgiveness for you, Sam, would make quite a difference.
I couldn't even imagine what that would do for my savings. You know, luckily have been able to, President Biden has pushed back that requirement start time quite a bit for me. So I've been able to push it back quite a bit. But, you know, once that starts hitting, you know, I'll have to prioritize rent and food over fun to make those student payment loans. And hey, that's fine. I wanted to be educated. I did. But, you know, I don't understand a society that wants to have, I'm not that you're not smart when you go to or when you don't go to college, but I think a society would want a better educated society in general just to do better. So when people ask me my college experience and all of my loans and everything, and they ask me if I would do it again, my honest answer is no. I would not do it again. I would probably jump into the workforce and set myself up for a better situation than I'm currently in.
So, you know, one of the arguments against the student loan forgiveness currently being leveled is that it's inflationary. And so my question is, with respect to inflation, if a student loan is forgiven, how do we expect, first of all, how do we expect that that money would have been spent or would be spent if the student loan is not being paid back? And I think for most of these students, they're experiencing hardships as the result of paying off their student loan. And what we're basically saying when we argue that forgiving a student loan will be inflationary is that we want to make sure that these people do experience hardships, and we don't want them to be able to, for instance, afford to pay somewhat more rent so they can live in a better environment. Do we have a caller?
We have Jack from Merrimack calling.
Jack, how are you?
Just pizza cheating, as my granny used to say. Anyway, I think I have the answer to a number of those questions, which is, why don't we provide daycare? Why don't we provide education, et cetera? And the answer is that if you're rich, you're never rich enough. The billionaires, I'm a retired teacher, and the billionaires pay taxes. The top 25, according to what I've read, pay taxes about a quarter of the rate that I pay as a retired teacher. That to me is an outrage. And when the universal college education was proposed by Bernie Sanders, his plan would have cost about $40 billion. At the same time, when our military budget was put into place, which, by the way, I'm sure you realize, actually has half of all of the discretionary spending in this country. It's just spent on war, excuse me, military, not war, of course. But in any case, he proposed universal college or schooling, at least above high school. And it would have cost, I think he estimated, $40 billion. And that particular year, the military budget was boosted by $60 billion that the Pentagon did not even ask for. So we've got the money. You know, it's available. You just have to tax people appropriately, not just the middle class and the lower class, but you have to tax the rich, you have to tax the big corporations, and you got to stop giving away money to big corporations as well.
That's the answer, I guess, for why it is that people would decide not to spend money on anything at all in the way of social programs. But how do you think an American political system and a social system can justify the notion that we would bring children into this world and then withhold from them the necessities that exist to make their life their life potential what it could be and what it should be in what they all express as being the most exceptional country in the world? How can we square that circle?
Well, the answer that the conservatives, I believe, would give you is that, well, everybody has the ability to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, which, of course, in this country, we all know is not true. You know, you have, for instance, people that have, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in college debt who are honestly trying to get an education good enough to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and all of a sudden they're into debt, owing more than I paid for my house for decades.
So stay on the line. We've got to take a brief break here. Stay on the line. We'll talk when we come back. Moving into the last quarter hour of the Earl Ingram Show, Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl. He had to go to his son's graduation for this last hour. We've got a caller on the line. We're talking about sort of the situation in our in this exceptional society of ours, which fails, however, maybe to meet all the needs of those newborn children that come into this world, particularly those who might be required to come into this world based on the right to life movement, but also just society at large in our country and how we're dealing with disproportionate possibilities. And the caller talked about the bootstraps. What were you saying about that?
Well, it's kind of hard to pull yourself up by your bootstraps when you don't even have enough money for shoes.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that bootstrap theory is that how does a two-year-old pull itself up by its bootstraps, right? Or a one-year-old? They can't even get their shoes on themselves, and no one would expect them to. I know this. I know that my DNA won the lottery at the time that I was conceived, because I was lucky enough to be conceived by a couple. I was born a white boy. I was born a white boy from a college-educated family, and my parents kept a nuclear family going and were very intent on providing me with everything I needed, and they had the wherewithal to do it. So my DNA won the lottery, but it wouldn't necessarily have won the lottery. It didn't have to work out that way. And then I would have been left to pull myself up by my bootstraps in the neonatal department of the hospital where I was born into. I just think that this notion of bootstraps is such an interesting one, and it sort of absolves society of any requirement whatsoever to operate as a community, because laissez-faire, right? If you're lucky, you're lucky. It's almost Malthusian. There was a famous economist in the early period of economic theory, David Malthus, and he was famous for his Malthusian population theory. Are you familiar with that one?
Vaguely, yes.
His theory was that the world would become overpopulated. But it wouldn't become overpopulated because as people became more crowded, it would just be a problem that solved itself through starvation and warfare. And so we didn't have to worry about it because it would just take care of itself. When too many people came into existence, they would kill one another or starve to death. No problem. And is that what the conservative view is as the solution for our social problems? Is it Malthusian that we're just going to let the people who are born into poor circumstances die of famine or kill themselves? Because that isn't a very good process for society at large. It's not a very humane process. It's certainly not an exceptional society solution. And yet, to some extent, it's the solution we seem to have adopted. We almost seem to have a Malthusian policy going with respect to children in this country. People who are born into horrible circumstances are left to read David Malthus and to come up with their own solution as to how they're going to avoid either the famine or the death by warfare. Yeah, you know, in our cities, we have food deserts, and we have dangerous communities. We have gun danger in our cities that is far different than that which exists around the rest of our society. And so, have we really retreated to that? And can we really, as an American body politic, pat ourselves in the back and say we're an exceptional society if the solution we've come up with for our children is basically Malthusian? And I think you've hit on a good point when you talk about bootstraps, particularly for children. You know, bootstraps work, I suppose, when someone's capable of taking care of themselves in society. But that doesn't really happen until we've become mature.
Well, and in many cases, because of poverty, it doesn't happen at all, really. That's, you know, that's part of the problem. The conservative approach seems to be articulated or have been articulated recently by our friend Ron Johnson, who has basically said, and I'm not quoting him exactly, but he basically said, why should somebody else's kids be my problem? Why should I finance somebody else's kids? Of course, the obvious answer to that is because it is to the benefit of society as a whole, which will benefit you. People like Ron Johnson, they're so rich, they figure, well, I don't care what happens to society. I can buy my way into a safe place, into a good position, and keep all of my benefits. And, you know, who cares about the rest? I mean, it's me and mine. That seems to be the conservative attitude. And I'm sorry, I'm not a conservative, so maybe I shouldn't be the one attempting to articulate this. But I think it seems to be the attitude.
I think you've definitely hit on something, but I'm afraid that in many respects that must reflect the general American cultural value, because the socio-political system that we've created honors that approach. Instead of being a society which embraces the family value of bringing every child into a circumstance of opportunity, we did not set up a social economic system like that. We do not have, and we haven't assured health care for every child. We have not assured daycare for every child. We have not assured maternal and paternal time and care for every child. And we have not assured education all the way through to adulthood for every child. And almost every other developed country has. You can go to almost every developed European country and immediately realize that the reason they've done that is they have fully embraced family values. And they have firmly realized the notion that it isn't just their family that needs to be valued. It's every child that's born into any family, into any circumstance, and that's the predominant value overriding all others. And it's worth paying taxes to support that kind of value, because you know what? Your DNA might not have been created in a circumstance in which you win the lottery at the time of conception. When you win the lottery is when you are born and nurtured and provided with all the opportunities to burst out into a society in which you can realize your full potential. And then the lottery winner is not only you who realize your full potential, but it's the society you live in who realizes the value of you realizing your full potential. And so I think you've really hit on something, and I think we can accuse conservatives of being the people without that value system, but I think we have to stand back even further and say, you know what? The American society as a whole must not have adopted that value. It must not be the overriding value in our society, because if it were, we would have a different socioeconomic system. And I think we're coming to a close here, but I think if this show could do anything, if we could guide our social debate into an analysis of whether we really embrace family values, and if by embracing those family values, we're willing to put our money where our mouth is from a tax standpoint and a political standpoint, we could, as America, become that exceptional country that we think we are. Because we would have to make a triage of expenditure analysis. We might spend less on military and more on children. And I would assert that is the trade-off we make. Thank you all for listening today. Earl will be back tomorrow, and have a good Wednesday.